Okay, well, I'm going to make a tentative start. For those of you who occasionally read Nature, you'll realize that until the next great revolution in physics, the future lies in engineering. That's what they tell us, sadly. And we've all got to get used to that. And so some aspects of my talk will be taking this to heart. I've decided over the last few years that I too should become an engineer. And what you're going to hear about today is our attempts at doing engineering-style calculations with all their nitty-gritty, trying to solve the Kondo problem systematically using a bosonic description of the spin. And I'll try to motivate why we've been trying to do that. The work that I'm going to talk about today has really a history that goes back. And I've worked at various times with Katrine and also with Indranil Paul. And the work I'm going to talk about today is really a collaboration between myself, Jerome Rech, Gheorghe Zarand, and Olivier Parcollet. So, Katrine has done a very nice experimental review, and I'm not going to go over that in great detail, but I'm just going to remind you that the way I see the question here, we have a whole bunch of materials, which is a function of some tuning parameter, x, go from the nail state into the Kondo heavy Fermi liquid state. And down here in the nail region, we see a Fermi liquid, an anti-Fermi magnetic Fermi liquid, and out here in the heavy fermion region, we also see a heavy Fermi liquid. And one of the big questions is the nature of this quantum critical matter that forms in this region here with its various properties, rho, going like T to the 1 plus alpha, specific heat capacity, which shows anomalies which grow, well, at least as fast as log T naught over T, maybe the possibility of omega over T scaling. Okay. And it's a grand challenge for us. And there are signs of a new universality emanating from this zero-temperature quantum critical point. Okay. So the question is, what's the right strategy to deal with this quantum critical point? And we're all searching for different approaches to this. And I think there's been a tendency to suppose that perhaps we need something very, very new. But in a way, you might ask, well, what's wrong with the old tried methods? And in particular, let me remind you that the old tried methods, which really go back to Weiss and Landau and Ginzburg, and more recently, Wilson, Kadanoff, and Fisher, is to start with a mean field theory, to expand it in terms of its long-range modes, and to acquire the critical Lagrangian. And then the tried method, well-tried method, has been to, in the region outside where the Ginzburg criterion holds, to use mean field theory and Gaussian fluctuations, but inside the Ginzburg region, to then apply the methods of RG. And, of course, this well-tried route might not apply to these systems, but I'm not prepared to give up on it. And so the question is, if this route works, then, first of all, what is the right mean field theory? Okay. And then, secondly, if we have the right mean field theory, how should we do the expansions around it? Okay. And so this then raises the question, do we have a mean field theory for this quantum phase transition? And the reason it's important is that down here at absolute zero, we have two well-defined ground states of matter that are connected mysteriously by a second-order phase transition, not by a first-order phase transition. Okay? And that means that one theory should apply to the whole region here, and that furthermore, down at absolute zero, we can forget about the fluctuations of our order parameter once we have it. Okay? And in fact, the data tell us that although the Fermi liquid extends over a smaller and smaller region, it is a Fermi liquid down here. So that down at the lowest possible temperatures, the Landau picture works. Likewise, on this side, as we cool down to the lowest possible temperatures, we do have a nail antiferromagnet with conduction electrons walking around it, and it does also seem to show something resembling a T-squared specific heat. And so this motivates the existence of perhaps a single mean field theory that will connect the two sides. If we had that theory, then the fluctuations around it would give us a clue into what the critical Lagrangian would be, and then we'd set down to it with methods of renormalization group. That would be the policy that I would think is the well-tried route and has not yet been exhausted. Okay. Now, the difficulty comes because, well, one idea would be that we treat this as a Stoner instability of a Fermi surface. And as you know, the Stoner instability is really, well, it's a descendant of Weiss. Of course, it gives rise to what we know as the Hertz theory of this phase transition with its damping. And as far as we can make out, many of these properties don't naturally fit into this picture. There may be ways out. We may be able to, there may be some quirks or some special features of these materials that we're not fully aware of. For example, they might be quasi-two-dimensional. Okay? But I'd like to explore the possibility that actually the root of our problems lie in the fact that we don't have the right mean field theory. Okay, that's the motivation behind the work I'm going to talk about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just to clarify that,
yes.
If I take a much simpler problem, ordinary Curie problem, okay, and I do what you sketch.
Ferromagnet, yes.
Then the exponents don't work either.
Right.
I wouldn't say I have the wrong mean field theory. So what
yes.
does that make you say we obviously have the wrong mean field theory?
I don't know the answer to that question. Okay? It's my answer. I think in that particular case, well, there is still the possibility in that particular case that we don't have the right mean field theory.
Isn't the difference that, at least for the active ferromagnet, we believe that we have included the fluctuations as good as possible within
that theory and still doesn't But I agree. In that particular case, you're quite right. We may have the right mean field theory, in which case the subtleties lie in the treatment of the long wavelength action,
yes.
Okay? You might be right in that particular case, okay, right?
We don't know that.
Okay, so we don't know that, okay? So I don't want to go there. But in this particular case, it's quite clear that one aspect of the physics that we don't have well described in the simple mean field theory, the Stoner theory, is the physics of the Kondo effect here. And so the question is, can we produce a mean field theory that will span this, describing local moment antiferromagnetism on the left-hand side, and heavy electron behavior on the right-hand side, okay? Can we produce a mean field theory? I'm not... Yes? I'm not going to assume anything of the sort. I'm going to ask, starting with a Hamiltonian that we might respect, can we find a controlled way of describing the mean field physics that goes into this transition here, okay? And hopefully, if we obtain a good mean field theory, we should have certain answers to that question, okay? Right? Okay. Now, this is something which has a long history. There was a time when no one believed you could even solve the heavy electron problem in a single impurity, even using mean field methods. There was a time when it was believed that you couldn't solve it exactly using greater ansatz. But what happened about 20 years ago was that one found a way of describing the physics on the right-hand side here, in a mean field theory. And that method, of course, has as its antecedents Abrakosov's approach of describing the spin as a fermion bilinear. And Abrakosov's method, of course, this describes a representation of SU2. You can generalize it to describe a representation of SUN, and you need to impose the number of fermions that you use here, which is some number Q, which typically is 1, right? Okay. Now, the Abrakosov method was later taken and made into a large N approach. And this was done by Reed and Nunes in the early 80s. And we extended it to the case of mixed valence using slave bosons. And this approach proved to provide a rather nice description of at least the back of the envelope aspects of the heavy electron phase. The old timers in the field at that stage would never accept this approach, I must say. And one of the reasons they were always uncomfortable with it was the fact that it didn't really describe the magnetism. And I spent 2 very happy years as a postdoc here trying to convince Bob Schrieffer that this method of using the large N and treating the spin as a fermion was a successful way of describing the basic physics of the Kondo effect, and he never acquiesced. Even one impurity and the lattice, you can do the lattice also with this method, okay? And it has some grave weaknesses to it. So that whilst it does describe the expansion of the Fermi surface, okay, and does give you an explanation of the heavy Fermi liquid in terms of some kind of what we would now call a composite fermion, okay? Well, what are the difficulties with it? One perhaps not so serious problem is that it describes the transition into the heavy electron phase as a second order phase transition, whereas it's actually a crossover, okay? But more seriously, it's very, very difficult to, without breaking within the strict limits of this large N theory, to describe antiferromagnetism. You can propose some ad hoc decoupling scheme, which typically is in the spirit of a spin density wave or Stoner approach that goes in parallel with it, but it's really not a controlled approach. Okay? Now, there is another way, which is the method of... Yeah. Well, I'll come back to why I think it's difficult in a moment. Yeah, we are dealing with the physics of confinement, and that's certainly difficult. But I'll give you another reason why there's some of my opinion about why this has difficulty describing magnetism in a moment. Okay, I'll come back to that. Okay, and I think it's to do with the representation that you're using as you go from spin a half to SUN, actually, as part of the problem. Okay? Now, if you take this case, which is the method we assigned to Julian Schringer because he wrote down a one-paragraph article on it in some unpublished place in the 1950s. This was then improved and applied by Arobus and Auerbach to the case of ordered antiferromagnets and low-dimensional antiferromagnets. It leads to a kind of gauge theory of magnetism. And these are now bosons, and you must, in the SU2, the number of bosons is equal to a number which is 2s, where s is the spin of the representation. Okay, and this is a beautiful method, the method that Arobus and Auerbach developed for antiferromagnetism. For me, it's a great example of a back-of-the-envelope mean field theory. Some things it can't do, but, for example, it can describe the essence of the gapped one-dimensional spin fluid, which I think is a tremendous achievement for a mean field theory. It can't describe the one-dimensional physics of the one-dimensional spin-a-half Heisenberg antiferromagnet, but it does capture the essence of the spin-1 antiferromagnet. It also can capture the fact that in the two-dimensional antiferromagnet, you have an exponentially growing correlation length. That's built in to the constraint here, and all of this at the mean field level. Okay? There are many things you need beyond mean field to. For example, this approach doesn't naturally capture valence bond formation. Okay? Curiously, this approach does, one of the interesting things. Now, okay, so what's the origin of the difference in physics that comes back to the representations here? Okay? The point is that you're never doing SU2, which is the case you really want. In the case of this problem here, to get a large N expansion, you have to let the number of fermions grow with N. Okay? So you're never dealing with NF equals 1. And so to describe the representations, one nice way of doing this is to draw a Young tableau. And a Young tableau represents anti-symmetric representations of SUN by a vertical column. And the number of boxes in this is basically the number of fermions you have at a given site. Okay? And if you want to describe in a simple picture the strong coupling limit of the Kondo problem, where you've got an interaction between the S's and the conductions, then what you're doing here is that you're binding N minus Q conduction electrons to Q F electrons in this approach, and that forms a singlet. Okay? Now, if you go to the case of the Schringer bosons, then the way you form a symmetric representation of spin S is that you actually form a row representation, where the number of boxes is given by the number of bosons here. Okay. And that's why you can actually increase the number of boxes and still do SU2 in this approach. And there's a close relationship between this approach for SU2 and the Holstein-Primakov approach to magnetism. Okay. And so, So here's the basic problem. The Kondo effect is the formation of singlets and naturally involves the formation of anti-symmetric representations of spins. Whereas anti-ferromagnetism really involves a highly symmetric wave function and is very naturally described in the language of bosons. And so crossing from one to the other is quite a hard thing to do. It's very hard using this method to describe magnetism. It's very hard using this method to describe the Kondo effect. Okay. And so what I'm going to talk about today is how you can use the Schwinger boson technique to describe the Kondo model and the two impurity Kondo problem. Okay? Right? We believe we've been able to do this with some success recently. Okay? And it's built upon a body of different efforts. And so let me try to describe you the difficulties of trying to have a large N expansion, first for the single impurity Kondo problem. Yes, Matthew.
Mm-hmm. That one really works with the actual field you have, with the symmetry you have.
Right.
Now, in hindsight, it is true that my generalizing was in the normalization group, the second stage.
Right. But it was, in the case where it was applied to, it was based on mean field theories that pre-existed the Lagrangians. The Weiss theory was in existence since 1906. But here we don't even have a mean field theory. That's the problem. Well, it might not be, but I think you do need to have a mean field theory somewhere, right?
But the mean field theory doesn't have to be exact, so why do we need the large N limit?
Okay, that's true. Well, I think...
And if you don't go to the limit, you have a gauge theory in either case. So
right. 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 So I don't know the full answer to your question, but I do believe that if I produced a mean field theory, which accurately described both sides, and it had a second-order phase transition, then I would have an alternative route rather akin to the spherical model for examining the critical physics. Okay? Right? Well, that... Anyway, I'm being an engineer in this talk, and so what I'm going to tell you about are the engineering aspects of trying to produce a large-end theory that correctly describes the physics of the Kondo problem and our first efforts to actually start to put in magnetism, okay? Right? And it's been it's actually been great fun. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to share it with you, actually. Okay, and presumably we might gain some more insight into these things if we could actually do that. Okay, so the history of this is the first effort to try and develop a large N treatment of the Kondo problem. And let's just write down what we're going to have here. We're typically going to be interested in an interaction which involves a Schwinger boson exchanging spin with a conduction electron at that site. Okay, and then that would be typically the nature of the strong coupling Hamiltonian that we've got to solve. And you've got to better solve that problem, and you've got to do it in such a way that your energy grows extensively with N. Okay? Now, the problem with the Schwinger bosons is that if you look at the strong coupling solution of this problem, it's very simple. You have one boson bound to N minus 1 fermions. conduction electrons, okay, psi electrons. That's the Young tableau for the singlet of this problem, okay? And you immediately see the difficulty because the energy involving only one box is not extensive in N, okay? So you may now allow your string of bosons to grow and have many of them, but the energy of this problem will only be of order 1 in N, not of order N in N. Whereas if you try and do a magnetic treatment of the problem, the energy is of order N. And so the Kondo physics will only be of order 1 compared to the magnetic physics, and you won't be able to see things in a mean field theory. So this method doesn't work. Now, it turns out that Olivier Parcollet and Antoine Georges found a beautiful way of overcoming this. Okay? And what they proposed was that let's introduce another index into here, which is then a channel index that runs from 1 to k. And let's allow k to grow with n. Now, why is that interesting? Well, it turns out that if k here exactly equals the number of Schrödinger bosons, then, in fact, each channel, here's channel 1, channel 2, all the way up to channel k, can form a singlet of its very own with the Schrödinger boson, forming this nice block, which is this SUN singlet. Okay? And so in the particular case of k equals nb, you can actually form a perfectly screened moment, okay, which is what we're interested in which the spin would be confined. Okay? Of course, if you take the case where nb is bigger than k, then you're dealing with underscreening. And if you take the case where nb is less than k, then you're dealing with overscreening. And only in the special case where NB equals, exactly equals, apparently, K, will you get the perfectly screened ground state. Okay? So Parcollet and Georges applied this approach to the single impurity Kondo problem and found a very nice treatment of the overscreened Kondo impurity. In particular, they were able to calculate the residual entropy of that model and compare it with the exact answers known from beta ansatz in the larger limit. Everything worked out beautifully. However, they left the model before they started looking at its Fermi liquid solution. And one of the reasons they did this was that you can see that you've only got here one boson bound to the n conduction electrons. And what this means in practice is that the phase shift of the conduction electrons, which when summed over all spin channels, must be equal to 1. And that means that the phase shift is then equal to pi over n. And so in this particular problem, the Kondo resonance you produce only dunks into the Fermi surface by an amount 1 over n. If you like, the Fermi surface barely expands at all. And they were disheartened by this, and they went on to apply their method to spin glasses and other problems, and it somehow got left standing at this particular point. And they never actually looked in detail at the nature of the Fermi liquid. Okay, so we've come back to this problem in part from the suggestions of Gheorghe Zarand, simply because, in fact, in the meantime, we found a way in which we can solve the phase shift problem if we want to. Okay, and in fact, this was the work that I did with Indra Nilpal, which was related to this. It was basically the idea of adding a color to the bosons rather than the channels. And as the number of boson colors increases, then so the phase shift becomes pi over n times the number of boson colors in this. And so you can get a finite phase shift. Ironically, though, with this approach, you still can't describe the perfectly screened Kondo problem. To get a large phase shift and describe the perfectly screened case, okay, turns out you need to put colors on both of these guys. And as Indra and I discussed in the paper on this, we can't do that problem because that's a matrix large N problem. And so a matrix large N problem requires future developments, maybe string theory, no one actually knows. So for the moment, we decide to go back to the problem where we just add channels, like Parcollet and Georges did, but now try to include the antiferromagnetism. So to do that first, we had to first go back and look at the Fermi liquid. And in particular, wanted to see whether we got a Fermi liquid. At first, it looked rather frightening, because if you look at NB over k here, then if nb is equal to 1, then you're at the Fermi liquid. But if nb is more than k, then you have the underscreened. And if nb is less than k, you have the overscreened. And both of these are singular or non-Fermi liquids. And so at first sight, it looks like you're doing the exact opposite problem to the one you want to do. Namely, a problem which you have a Fermi liquid state halfway between two non-Fermi liquid states. And if you don't get things completely right, presumably you'll always cross over to non-Fermi liquid behaviors that go down. So it looked scary to us at first sight. And it turns out that our fears were unjustified for reasons that I'm now going to tell you. And in fact, this model provides a very nice way of describing the Fermi liquid. It's something we've only discovered recently. So the first thing we set down to doing was trying to understand this model numerically, but also looking at it from the point of view of Ward entities. And to cut to the chase, this model, in the case where k is not equal to nb, describes unconfined spin-ons. And only in the case where k equals nb do the spin-ons actually confine. And in fact, there's a gap in the spin-on spectrum that develops at that particular case. And one way you can see this is if you look at this model and you introduce a chemical potential or a constraint term that couples to nb minus the nb, the number of bosons, minus some number, we'll call it 2s here, then as you solve the problem as a function of lambda, you can look at the value of nb as a function of lambda in the, in the grand canonical ensemble. And so if I plot minus lambda here, that's like a kind of chemical potential. And as you raise minus lambda, the number of bosons increases. And so if you look at the ground state solutions for this, nb of lambda, what happens is it comes up and you hit a critical value of lambda and it locks in at exactly k. And then you keep increasing it beyond the second critical value of lambda, then it goes on up like that. Okay? This is the property of the solutions of this model in the single impurity case. And so this reminds you of what happens in an insulator or metal with an insulating gap. Namely, as you increase the chemical potential, you're first in the conduction in the valence band, and then you hit the gap, and then you go up into the conduction band. So this suggests, interestingly enough, that overscreened is like being in the valence band of the spin-ons. Underscreened is like being, if I got that the right way around, maybe back to front here. Overscreened is like being in the conduction band of the spin-ons, and underscreened, I'll get it right in a minute. This is overscreened, and this is underscreened. Okay? And what happens if you look at the spectrum of the bosons in this particular problem is that indeed, if this is the energy versus, and out here I'm sort of schematically going to draw, this is the situation for k equals nb, whereas when you're in the overscreened case, you find that your renormalized lambda goes to zero, and you have something that looks gapless with power law correlations coming here. This is when k is actually greater than nb. Okay. And you have a remnant of this thing up here, and so this is zero here. And likewise, when k is less than nb, what you have is a situation where you've got a lot of gapless excitations around zero, and you're in the upper band. The conduction band here. And there is actually a sharp gap here in this problem. Now, we understand this behavior in terms of Ward identities for this particular model. Okay? And it turns out that you can apply the classical methods of Ward and Luttinger to this model of interacting bosons and fermions. And maybe this just deserves a small aside. So small single impurity, right. Okay, right, okay. However, these Ward's entities apply to the lattice as well, so it's worth mentioning them momentarily. Okay. Turns out that Luttinger and Ward, back in the early 60s, developed a very nice method of describing the free energy of interacting systems. And you can, what they did was to provide a way of describing the free energy of the interacting electron system as a functional of either the self energy or the propagators of the particles. And their result was F equals minus T, and they had a term which looked like the trace of the log of the inverse Green's function plus that was the Luttinger free energy, Luttinger Ward free energy. And this is stationary with respect to variations of G and sigma. This is the sum of all skeleton free energy graphs, okay, link cluster diagrams. Okay, and this is, as far as we know, an exact relationship which can be extended to the case of interacting bosons and fermions. In their case, the Coulomb interaction was just an interaction. The photons were integrated out. You can generalize this to the case of interacting electrons and bosons, and a very convenient way to write it is like this. Where supertrace tells you that you take the with a positive sign for bosons and a negative sign for fermions. And it turns out that this can be used to derive certain rigorous identities that must be satisfied by the ground states of the problem. Ward and Luttinger use this approach to derive the Fermi surface sum rule. Okay? And the way they did this was to a sketch of their derivation is that they recognized that because of charge conservation, what you could do is that you could shift the frequencies inside the various loops inside Y at absolute zero without changing Y. And this then led to an identity which told you that the change in Y was basically some integral over frequency of the self energy with dg by d omega, and that was equal to zero. And with this Ward identity, you could then prove the Luttinger sum rule. Now, it turns out that you can use a generalization of that identity for the case of interacting bosons and fermions. In fact, this was alluded to by Subir Sachdev in his talk a few weeks ago. And when you do that in this particular problem applied to the Condor problem, what's very interesting is that, well, first of all, you have to decouple this interaction here. Okay? And as Catherine mentioned, the decoupling procedure for this model basically introduces a term which looks like this. I'll just write it. That's the decoupling scheme. And so you have the interaction between a chi-Grassmann field, a boson, and a fermion coming in here. Okay, and it turns out that the Luttinger sum rule for this problem involving charge conservation, because the charge is passed from the psi field to the chi field here, it must then involve the phase shifts of the chi and the psi. Or in the case of the lattice, the volume of the Fermi surface of the chi and the volume of the Fermi surface of the psi. They're related to one another. Okay. Now, chi is the fermion that carries the Condor interaction. And so, for example, the propagator of chi in the single impurity problem, or actually we could make it a lattice problem, doesn't really matter, is 1 over J Condor, this thing you have here, minus the self-energy for the chi. And this self-energy carries all of the logarithmic renormalizations of J. Now, at omega equals zero, the imaginary part of this self-energy becomes zero. That's important because if, for example, if we look at in the case of the single impurity problem, the phase shift of the chi is the imaginary part of the log of basically minus G inverse. Perhaps I can write it as 1 over J minus sigma of chi. Okay. And there's an award of density in this problem that tells you that delta chi over pi times the number of channels, k, is equal to the number of channels times the number of spin flavors, and there's a minus sign here, times delta of the conductions over pi. Okay? And this is an exact identity, as far as we know. Now, what's interesting about this problem is that delta chi really measures whether you've gone to strong coupling or not. And if you've gone to strong coupling, it turns out that the sign of J flips over and becomes ferromagnetic, as Catherine alluded to. And what that then means is that delta chi is equal to pi in the case where you have strong coupling, and it's equal to zero where you have no Kondo effect at all. Right? And you can actually see this by introducing a magnetic field into the problem. And you'll see this phase shift evolve from pi to zero as you turn on the magnetic field. Okay? So what's interesting in this particular case, and I think there's a minus sign there, is that you can see very easily that if delta chi is equal to minus pi, then delta C is equal to pi over n. Okay? Well, you can use this and you can calculate the susceptibility as a function of temp.
It's pi over n, it's not pi over 2.
Yes. Well, if n's equal to 2, it's pi over 2. Yeah.
No, but then it's back to what we did.
Mm-hmm. It's no different to what.
There is no pi over n, pi over 2 phase shift for this model.
Correct.
So, how can you say there is complete Kondo?
Well, okay, so. Yeah, okay, that's a great question. So what can you do? You can see it in various different ways. One of the things you can do is you can look at the thermodynamics of your solution, okay? You can write down an exact expression for the entropy of this problem, and you can watch the temperature dependence of the entropy as a function of temperature. And you can actually derive the zero temperature value of the entropy in this approach. That was derived by Parkley and Georges. And you can then look at the temperature derivative, and that's one of the things that I showed you. You get a very nice thing like this for CV over T in the case where NB equals K. But if NB is not equal to K, or indeed if you're not on that flat part of the curve I drew you, what happens is that you end up starting to get the classic divergences associated with non-Fermi liquid behavior. Okay? So you see that. And the other way of seeing this is that although there's only one...
May I just make a...
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You can get screening of the spin within this model.
Yes.
But it's difficult to know whether you have, since the phase shift is not pi over 2, it's difficult to know whether the spin degrees of freedom has been totally injected in the Fermi surface or not.
No.
Say it in other words.
No.
If you apply the model for a lattice, do you believe it gives a big Fermi surface?
Okay. My first answer to that is that not only can we see that this water density is satisfied in our solution, we can furthermore look at the phase shift of the conduction electrons, okay, in the problem. And we can see explicitly, it's not approximately, but exactly equal to pi over n.
So when n goes to infinity, it's zero.
But the point is, we can calculate that coefficient of 1 over n.
So what I mean is, the n goes to infinity limit of this model doesn't have the big Fermi.
But we can, in other words, we can calculate the leading order 1 over n correction very, very easily without any extra work.
Okay, let's be precise. The change of volume of Fermi surface is of order 1 over n.
I'm not doing the Kondo lattice at the moment, okay? Right? Yes, yes, that's fine. So, okay, so now let's go and look at what happens when you go and include antiferromagnetism into the mean field theory. And here, the basic interaction, we use the SP2N formulation introduced by Reed and Nunes. Okay, and what this does is when at the mean field level, this is basically the same as a Robus and Auerbach, it introduces boson pairing. And this is indeed a complex gauge field in general. Okay, right? Now, the question is, can we now bring this together with the large N approach I just described to you? And what do we see when we do that? Okay. So the obvious place to apply this to start up as a warm-up problem is the two impurity Kondo problem. Okay? Right. It turns out to be a very simple extension of the one impurity calculations to do the two impurity anti-ferromagnet. The two impurity ferromagnet is a little bit more work in actual fact. Okay? So let me draw you the basic phase diagram that this problem has. And this is now TK over J Heisenberg, and this is T over J Heisenberg. Okay? The first point is that when TK is much, much bigger than J Heisenberg, we just have decoupled single impurities, and delta does not develop an expectation value. So nothing has changed. Okay? However, if we now go to the case of where JH is larger than a certain critical value, turns out there's a phase boundary that looks like this. Okay? And inside here, delta is not equal to zero, okay, right, in the mean field theory. What does that correspond to? It corresponds to the beginnings of the formation of a valence bond between the bosons at site 1 and site 2, okay, right? And in the extreme limit where JH is infinitely larger than TK, all we have here is just the molecule of two spins, okay? But don't forget that coming down here, I have the formation of this Fermi liquid on this scale of order TK. And so now I can look at what happens to that as I come in along here. Furthermore, another interesting thing I can do is I can look at the phase shift of delta chi, okay, which is an order 1 quantity, which you may remember in the impurity, is equal to pi or minus pi, which indicated I'd gone to strong coupling. And I can ask, how does this evolve as I come in through here? For the case of the anti-ferromagnet, for the two impurity case only, chi does not disperse even when delta becomes finite. And the reason for that is the following. If you look at the self-energy for the chis, then it involves the propagation of a conduction electron, and then it involves a boson propagator here. Now, it turns out that when you've got two sites, the only way the boson can travel from site 1 to site 2 is through the anomalous term. And so unless the conduction electrons were paired, there would be no intersite coupling. However, if you have a ferromagnetic coupling or across the diagonal in a lattice, then you can have direct propagation from site 1 to site 3 of the boson, and this now develops K dependence. So in the lattice, the chi fermion develops a K dependence in general, okay? Whereas in the single impurity, its self-energy is not K independent, nor in the two impurity case, okay? So what this means is that we can very simply generalize things, and we can watch this as a function of TK over JH. And one of the amusing things that happens as we tune this thing is that it jumps downwards like this, not at this point here, which is, which I'll just call 1. Okay, that point is here. Okay, it turns out there's a critical point here too, where this phase shift drops to zero, okay? And furthermore, we find that the region of Fermi liquid behavior shrinks down towards zero as we approach this point, and we have a zero-point entropy at this point here, and then it grows up again as we come away from here, okay? The gap in the boson is present everywhere except for this point here, where it becomes deconfined. And as far as we can make out, what we're just rediscovering here is the Jones-Varma fixed point of the two impurity Kondo problem. And what's interesting is that this simple little mean field theory captures all the main physics of the Jones-Varma fixed point. Now, it's a singlet operator. That's right.
This is a valence bond singlet stick, not a nail magnet.
That's right. I did not say this was a nail antiferromagnet. It's a valence bond singlet state. Okay. So that's what we can do in the two impurity, and I can't claim to what happens beyond this, but I can tell you what what we can see now from looking a little bit ahead. We actually did try to do the lattice first and then realized we had to go back to this problem to warm up. So just in the last few moments, let me tell you about the lattice. Okay. Now, by the way, the fact that this phase shift jumps like this is particular to n bigger than 2. When n equals 2, this doesn't happen in this model, unless you have perfect particle-hole symmetry. Okay? So it turns out that there are inter-site effects higher order in 1 over n, which you have to take into account in principle, which can make the chi fermion disperse. And in that case, you no longer have what, in particular, one of the important things is that our sum rule now gives us delta C symmetric plus delta C anti-symmetric. And so you can evolve all the way from pi over 2 for both of these, all the way to 0 and pi in the case of the particle hole asymmetric problem. And so the Varma-Jones fixed point doesn't exist for SU2, for an asymmetric particle hole channel. However, I think we can make some very strong arguments that for SU3, or in fact any n bigger than 2, that in fact it does exist. Because in that particular case, these things are pi over n. And they can never add up to be equal to, they never add up to pi. And therefore, you can never reach the point where both are equivalent to 0, mod pi. Okay, so what this does illustrate is that mean field theory can describe a quantum critical point quite nicely. That's all it illustrates. And that we've been able to include the leading effect of the magnetism in the mean field theory. Okay, that's what we've been able to do. Yeah, Andreas. Yes. Yeah, I can't answer that because we haven't taken it far enough at this point to answer that. I don't know. We don't know yet what the specific heat does in this region here, in particular. Okay. And the other interesting thing that we haven't calculated of experimental interest is the susceptibility between the conduction electrons and the F electrons. As you know, there's an empirical relationship derived recently by Schmali and Curro and Pines, which suggests this thing looks like this for a wide range of almost anti-ferromagnetic heavy electron systems. And one of the things we're hoping is that that quantity actually describes this region here. Okay? And I can tell you more about that momentarily. Right? So let's just talk about how this mean field theory will evolve when we go to a lattice model. Okay? Right? Okay? 5 minutes. That's okay. That's okay. 5 minutes is just fine. Okay. Are you telling me I don't have 5 minutes?
No, but I'm just saying, make it fast 5 minutes.
4 minutes and 55 seconds. 4 minutes and 55 seconds, yeah. Okay. So when you go to the lattice, the mean field theory, mean field equations can still be written down in that particular case. However, in that particular case, now what happens is that the chi fermions start to move once the delta becomes finite. The boundary I've shown you here is the same for the lattice and for the sink, the two impurity problem. What's different is what happens beneath this boundary in the mean field theory. And so what can we say about that in that particular case just heuristically? Here's the boundary where delta is not equal to 0. Okay? We know way down here we have another boundary where the Schringer bosons actually condense. That's the nail state forming, okay, in three dimensions in particular. Okay? And that's presumably a boundary which comes down like this. Okay?
And
this is temperature here. And this is still TK over JH, okay, like that, okay, right? And however, to calculate this and solve the mean field theory exactly, in principle, you now need to take into account the fact that the chi fermions have a propagation, okay? We believe, however, that a good first treatment of this problem is to actually ignore this K dependence, okay? Although I can... you know how it is. You try it. If it works, then you say it works, okay? We've done some initial calculations which show that this is indeed second order within that scheme. So that's interesting. And the other thing that's interesting is that, well, you see, What's happening here when delta becomes finite is that the Kondor effect's becoming non-local. That's what's really happening here. And the fact that bosons can hop from one site to another means that the screening process does not occur locally anymore. You introduce new channels, and the reason this temperature goes to zero here is because of a competition between two channels. This is physics that's discussed in a recent paper by Miyake and Varma also. That once you start to grow anti-ferromagnetic correlations, you start to get a competition between different screening channels. And we believe that when the boson condenses, the same type of competition grows here. Now, what are we going to have here? We have the bottom of the boson dispersion, which is a quantity which is coming continuously down to zero here. Okay? And to make this point vanish, we have to work much less hard in the lattice than we do in the two impurity case. Okay? That singular point is a much larger value of TK over H. But so we don't know what's really going on here, but it'll be very interesting to see whether, first of all, whether in this region here we have an unusual specific heat capacity, something that we can compute. Secondly, do we see, the other interesting thing about this is that because the chi fermions start to move, this sum rule that I mentioned to you before now becomes that the volume of the Fermi surface of the chi fermions is equal to n times the volume of the Fermi surface, the change in the volume of the Fermi surface of the conduction electrons. Okay? Now, what we believe happens as you come along here is that the chi fermions remain confined, which means that they have a completely filled Fermi surface. That down here, there is no Fermi surface for the chi fermions at absolute zero, all the way along here. And in fact, that's necessary in order to have a Fermi liquid, which is described by the conventional description of a Fermi liquid. If the chi fermions were not gapped, then you need additional parameters to describe the thermodynamics of the ground state. And so it's very necessary, if this picture is to work as we come along here, that the chi fermions remain completely gapped as we come in along here. Otherwise, we'll have additional contributions to the Fermi liquid behavior. It will not be a conventional Landau Fermi liquid. If they are completely gapped, then their Fermi surface has volume 1, and that will mean that the change in the volume of the Fermi surface of the conduction electrons is equal to 1 over n. Okay? We don't have to calculate this thing here. We just have to calculate this thing here. And that's something that's defined in the large N approach. And so because of this Ward identity, we can follow the evolution of the Fermi liquid ground state as we come along here. Okay? So that's all I have to say about it. This is work in progress, and I just wanted to tell you about it.